There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
So our castaway guest this weekend is none other than international journalist, author and public speaker Riz Khan. He's known worldwide for his flagship TV shows on CNN International and Al Jazeera English, of which he was a founding director. Not only did Riz launch the first global live interactive talk show Q&A with Riz Khan, but through the span of his career, he has conducted more than 10,000 interviews, but has never, to our knowledge, been stranded on a desert island with only three books to read. So Riz, welcome to the show. Is that true?
Thank you, Annabelle. I haven't been stranded on a desert island. I've been to a few little desert islands here and there. But I would dread the idea, because when I was young, I had this kind of, I don't know why, in my head about, if I was on an island, how would I survive? So since I was young, I was obsessed with things being mechanical, so they weren't battery dependent.
Oh, right.
So, you know, a watch had to be mechanical. I had to have a penknife. So as a kid, I was obsessed with the idea that what if I was stranded somewhere and needed to survive? I think I watched Robinson Crusoe as a kid, and I just got kind of obsessed with it.
That's quite practical thinking as well for a kid, really.
It is, actually. Yeah, so, but when you're a kid, the world is big. Yeah.
So in a way, this is kind of like fulfilling a childhood dream.
In a way, it is, yeah. And I used to love listening to Desert Island Discs and so on the BBC, because it was always fascinating being stuck with only, you know, three books. I just thought, this is torture, because I read so much. It would be, you know, I always trying to figure out what would I take that would allow me to not get bored with the idea of reading them again and again, you know.
So when you were making the decision, I mean, that's obviously the main criteria. Were there any that kind of didn't make the cut?
Yeah, you know, because I'm quite practical. And I worked with words. Though my background was originally medical, I ended up as a journalist, and then words became so important. And even the way I had to write and speak changed, going from science to journalism. So I ended up, you know, stopping the use of words like attenuate, potentiate, augment. You know, they had to be simple words. You know.
All the good words.
Yeah. So, you know, as much as I appreciate English as language is amazing, but the thing is, I had to just simplify it, because that's what happens. You have to go with essentially the lowest common denominator, which is getting even lower and lower each day when it comes to TV audiences. So for me it was always, you know, what would I do with words? I always thought I'd end up with something like an Encyclopedia Britannica, a dictionary. I'd always loved the idea of, because I could just study the words. There were so many things, and I think those are the things that would have been, you know, practical things to take. But I guess the idea here is we add a bit more color to it and take books that we've enjoyed a lot.
Speaking of books that you have enjoyed, what is your first book that you're bringing with you?
So the first one I'm trying to think in the order I gave them to you, but
Let's start with Shantaram.
Shantaram, okay, good. Yeah, that was the first one, I think, because I originally had them in a different order in my head because of the publishing dates and when I read them. But let's start with Shantaram. The reason for me, that was a significant book, and I know you've had other guests on before who've named that book too, is it actually gave me a kind of epiphany of when it comes to poverty. Gregory David Roberts, so the basic story is, you know, a convict who escapes Australia, maximum security prison, and ends up in the slums of Bombay, Mumbai, as they call it now, of course. And he goes on a massive adventure. He ends up with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. He's with a sort of gangster, a city gangster there. He ends up in a slum running a free clinic, medical clinic, because he has a bit of first aid knowledge and so on. And it's a very, very colorful and very intense book, and there's, you know, it's just some fascinating characters. And it's based on his life, you know, he's a real life character. I never got to meet him, though. I was lining up an interview with him for my show, as it happens, and he was one of those around when the shootings happened in Mumbai, when I was actually there, would you believe, as it mm-hmm. happened, ended up reporting. Now the thing about Shantaram, for me, one of the things that stuck with me was when he arrived in India and he looked at the poverty around him. The way he assessed it was, he said, you know, it's funny, we tend to always look with just pity at the impoverished, those in slums. We tend to look at them as people who have nothing, who really deserve our pity. And he said, when he looked around, he saw a guy, you know, with no legs in a kind of makeshift wheelchair, with these young kids, you know, dressed in rags, hanging off it, and the guy was spinning around, they were giggling and laughing. He said, even in their poverty, they found joy. And there's nothing to say that someone who's poor can't be happy, you know, and they're entitled to it. In fact, probably more entitled than everyone else, you know, who can sort of buy it, inverted commas. So it made me stop and think that every time I've always had this kind of deep, because I love it. It's, you know, people used to ask me, Where are you from? You know, how do you relate to your kind of ethnicity and so on? I said, well, the way I always describe it is that, and at the time I was living in Atlanta when I was with CNN, I said, my body's in America, my mind is in Britain, because that's where all my formative years were, you know, so I'm very British that way, but my heart's in Bombay, you know, because I am, at the heart of it, I'm Indian, you know, I'm South Asian. So that city, Bombay, which I still prefer the name Bombay, it has a very deep pull for me. But every time I go there and I see, I have a friend, he's brilliant. I mean, he's a top international drummer. And his studio is in this underneath these sort of arches in like an aqueduct, a viaduct, actually. And next to it is a slum. So one day we were offloading this really expensive gear into his studio, and I saw this little kid with just in rags, actually a ragged top, naked below, just watching us with fascination because of all these glittery things coming out of this big truck, you know, this van, going into the studio. And of course, just kids curious. And I just, you know, my heart just kind of crunched up. I just thought, this poor kid has nothing, not even something to wear around his, you know, private parts. But that's the thing that Shantaram did for me. It was made me think again. I said, you know what? That doesn't mean this child isn't entitled to be happy and can be happy, can experience joy. Obviously, it's a difficult life. But it gave me a different perspective. So Shantaram was quite an eye-opener of a book. And then the funny story with it is that it's quite a big book. And I was carrying the book around and reading it on airplanes. I was traveling, as I do, pretty much all the time. And I kept, I think, about three copies I left in the back of the seat. I never leave things on airplanes, honestly, never. But three copies of this book, two of them were in airplanes, one was elsewhere, but were left in the back of the seat. And I walked out and was like, ah, I forgot the book. And it made me think, you know, I just hope someone picks that book up and reads it. So I kind of felt destined to pass this book around inadvertently.
What a great present for someone if they're boarding the plane and they find it. I wanted to ask you, I know that book got a lot of sort of heat in the media at some point because it was discussed that some of the events were sort of exaggerated of his life. Yeah. I was wondering if that affected your reading of it or your thoughts of it after.
So my connection with it was more on the descriptions of the city. I thought it was very well written. That emotional connection or that kind of insight it gave me or a different perspective it gave me on poverty was quite important. In terms of the content, I mean, Gregory David Roberts actually does say it's loosely based on my life. And it's meant to be a book of fiction. It's meant to be a story that people can read and enjoy. So I don't judge it that way. Mm. I think people are looking for, you know, often look for things as a way to kind of say, well, wait a minute, you know, that's not right. Well, if you're reading a book to enjoy it, then try to enjoy it and not simply pick it apart. You know what I mean? Mm. So from that perspective, it didn't bother me. Mm.
What actually happened to Gregory David Roberts in the end? Did he ever turn himself in, or did he just...
I'm trying to recall because it was a while ago I read it, but he pretty much led a free life after that. He stayed in India, and I remember at the time of the shootings in Mumbai, I was actually doing some other interviews and a whole bunch of other stuff, like a mix between politics and Bollywood stars. I had Shah Rukh Khan interview on that trip and so on. And when the shootings happened, I was actually up in the north end of the city in Bandra when... there was a curfew, so suddenly I was trapped in the hotel up at the other end and trying to report, because by that time they were calling me as the only person on the scene, though I wasn't actually at the scene, I was further away. And I felt kind of a bit of a phony reporting from a hotel room where I was on lockdown. But the next morning we managed to weave our way down to the areas, you know, the Taj and the Oberoi and so on, where the shootings happened, and set up a live broadcast unit where I just end up doing 2-3 days of live coverage. And we did want to try and get him because Leopold's Cafe, one of the landmarks, you know, where there was the attack kind of spread out into that area too, because a lot of the expats are there. He's one of those who hangs out, and the cafe is mentioned a lot in the book. So I was trying to get him for the show or for the live reports and stuff, but he was around, and people say he's kind of kept more of a low profile nowadays, but he is around still.
Yeah, because I wondered as well, seeing as they were trying to make a movie of this, and mm-hmm. that's something that's been stuck in production to and froing for a long time.
Yeah, I heard that Johnny Depp had bought the movie rights for it, but what happened since, I don't know.
And I heard he was possibly writing another.
Well, that's the irony. He wrote this massive piece, and they said, you know, it's the start of a career as a novelist. But as far as I know, nothing else has come out. So
maybe he didn't like the attention.
Maybe. He's pretty much a hippie kind of character. Yeah. So, you know.
I've been wanting to read Shantaram for quite a while, but I know it sounds silly, but the length of it always puts me off because of everything else that I'm reading. I mean, if you were going to sell it to me and say why I should read it, or why somebody should read Shantaram, who would you recommend it to?
Well, it's quite thick, so if you get tired, you can always use it as a bed rest or a pillow.
Excellent recommendation.
No, but actually, I would say, look, the thing about it is, it's true, you know, when a book is that big, there's a tendency. You know, I was thinking about this the other day because I had that issue with A Suitable Boy, Vikram Seth's book, which is one of the first South Asian authors, you know, to come out with this kind of book. And I was thinking, this thing is like giant, you're carrying it around. I'm already in excess baggage with this thing. The thing is, now with everything being, you know, with e-books, it does make me wonder, you don't have this, you know, connection to the length of the book because it's all there electronically. So do you think, I'm not going to read it because look at the size of it, I'll never get through that, because you don't know. So I wonder if someone saw it as an e-book, whether they'd even have that consideration. But I would say read it because the story, it does draw you in. It's very colorful. And as a journalist, I had to learn to take the adjectives out. Mm-hmm. So for me, as someone who then started writing as well, it became incredibly frustrating that I'd read my stuff and say, you know, I haven't really described anything. And even when I wrote the book on Al-Waleed bin Talal, which was actually a documentary that kind of turned into a book, I end up going back and adding adjectives, you know, just to try to make it a little more visual. Because with radio, I learned to describe things a little more colorfully because I learned radio journalism. So, you know, for writing with color was a challenge.
So you think the writing aspect and the description, of the book is a really good...
And it drew me in, and it just, the story weaves through so many different elements. It's really, really quite fascinating.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
We just had a text in saying, just start reading Shantaram, you cannot stop it, because we were talking about maybe the length would put some people, myself included.
Actually, that's the best way to describe it. It is hard to put down.
Yeah. So what's book number two?
So that's The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant the Unbeliever. And that I read when I was 15. It was published in 1977, which takes it back a while. And I remember a friend of mine recommending it to me because I just read Lord of the Rings, and I loved Lord of the Rings. And in fact, the day I finished it, that night I dreamt I was with Frodo on the ship leaving, and I was in tears when I woke up. It was like, I was so affected by that book.
Anyway, just to paint a picture for listeners, he's saying this as he sports a pop art Dalek shirt.
That's right. Doctor Who lives on. And is a woman now, which is great. Mm. So what happened was the friend of mine said to me, you know, you've got to read this book. If you like Lord of the Rings, read this, The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant the Unbeliever by Stephen Donaldson. So again, three large books, a trilogy. And I was really quite drawn into it because it was almost like Lord of the Rings in the sense it was a fantasy world. There's giants and there's an evil, like there's a bit like the sorcerers, you know, the Sauron and Saruman kind of characters. But it was much more adult in theme. Mm. It's about you know, this kind of very bitter and angry man who's gone through a bad divorce. He's trying to reconnect with his wife. He's a leper. Leprosy is a disease which affects the nerves. Ironically, and I ended up studying neurology at university, imagine. But the funny thing is, leprosy still exists. I actually sat on a plane next to a man who was the head of the American Leprosy Association. And talked about it. I thought they, you know, pretty much had a cure. He said, no, there are still people who have leprosy. And the danger for lepers is, if they injure themselves, they often don't feel it because the nerves are dead, and they can get infections and gangrene sets in, and they can lose limbs, you know, and you know, so on because of this. So it was quite funny, if I remember it in the book correctly from way back when, VSE, visual surveillance of extremities. So this guy, Thomas Covenant, is constantly doing VSEs, visual surveillance of extremities to make sure there's no injury. Anyway, the reason it fascinated me was because, again, it's got some very adult themes. You know, he ends up in this other world.
Can you tell us how he ends up there? Like,
he basically, he kind of stumbles, cracks his head on a table, coffee table, and he wakes up in this, and he's got a fear of heights. He wakes up on this kind of multi, you know, this tower that's like a post with a ladder going down. It's like in a watchtower kind of thing, you know, hundreds of feet in the air. Anyway, it's kind of a sad and brutal story in the sense that he's saved by this young woman because as a leper he's, you know, he hasn't got his potency anymore and he's impotent, and in this new land everything comes back, and so he starts going through the guilt of that because she still loves him. And so there's a love story and a very twisted element to his character as he's trying to reconcile these bad aspects of himself. And in the meantime, he's trying to save this other world because he wears a white gold wedding ring, which in this fantasy world wields power. But the story's brilliant, the way it goes on, the characters, and it just kind of really drew me in. And I read the three books. And then Stephen Donaldson carried on writing. So the last one, it's now 10 books. Mm. And he wrote the last one in 2017. So he's basically been writing like for 36 years.
Wow.
Crazy. 2013, sorry, I think it was. So 26 years he's been, 36 years he's been writing these. So I have to go back and read them all again so I can, because I didn't realize since then he'd written that many more. I read there was another sequence, another trilogy, made it 6 books. I read those. But now 10 of them, so I've got my reading cut out for me.
The thing that struck me about this, so two things. So the fact that he's constantly questioning, it's a bit of a Matrix dilemma in that he's constantly questioning what is real. Mm-hmm. So is what he's imagining real, or was his former life real? And also, the thing that kind of, I don't know whether I want to read it or I don't want to read it, because he's such an unlikable character.
Yeah,
he doesn't sound very likable.
And yet, this is the thing, you're rooting for him. You know, we always end up rooting for the bad guy in some way. We hope they kind of, you know, will survive. And yet, at the same time, you think, you know, he deserves some kind of terrible fate. But the irony is that he's looking for to you know, sort of get out of this deep, bitter situation. And the thing is, he gets knocked back into the real world, if you like, a couple of times. And then he's desperate to go back to this land to finish the task of trying to save this land.
And he's a writer, right?
That's right.
Which I think is really interesting, because you think, well, is this a part of his imagination? Is this something that when he comes back to the real world, he's going to write and it's going to fix all his problems? That's kind of what I was thinking. Yeah.
You know, the irony of the whole thing is that Stephen Donaldson, the author, I mean, you know, he's written some other brilliant pieces as well, but he actually spent a lot of his time in India. Not a lot of his time, sorry, his early years in India. And so there's an ironic twist linking the first and second book here.
I don't think
he wrote it in the slums of Bombay.
Castaway. What's your literary sustenance on a desert island?
Now, the third book that you're going to be talking about, I'd never heard of before.
Right. So Amin Maalouf is a very well-respected writer in the Middle East. He's Lebanese, and he's won a number of prizes. I was actually first pointed to a book of his called Leo Africanus. And Baltazar's Odyssey, the book that I've chosen, is in some way similar. And the thing about Amin Maalouf's writing style, he actually writes in French originally, and then they got translated into English, is his writing style is so deep. After I read Baltazar's Odyssey, I thought, you know, one day I'd love to write a book like this. I mean, it's so, so well written. But, you know, I could leave it as a legacy for my daughter. I literally thought of it this way. Excuse me. I'd love to be able to do something about, I don't know, I have almost no family history because we kind of fled civil war and God knows what else, but I would love to have written a kind of history of my family in this way. It's set in the 17th century and follows a young man who goes through across what they used to call the civilized world, you know, from Constantinople to London. But he goes through the Ottoman Empire. He's in search of this very rare book. It's got a sort of mysterious, almost curse about it. But it's fascinating, the adventures he goes on. It's so beautifully written. The language that Amin Maalouf uses is just so rich. It's just so rich. And it's so different from most of the other stuff. And I think maybe as a journalist who's always had to take out these kind of descriptives, it struck me even more as a book that's very, very powerful. Leo Africanus was good, but this one just resonated with me more. And I really enjoyed reading it.
And is it sort of, it's not a fantasy? Is it a fantasy or is it family history or is it?
No, he's made up the story. I mean, he describes describing, you know, a world like almost 500 years ago, 400 years ago. The depth with which he describes it, it feels like, you know, you would believe he was there. He's actually seen all this. I was thinking, how can he be so descriptive about a time so far back? I love this when people can bring a richness of description that makes you feel you've gone back in time and are actually there.
Must have researched a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure. And even Leo Africanus is a very similar kind of thing. You know, it's again another man on a journey going through and doing this. So, and maybe that's a theme he likes. But it really is beautifully, beautifully descriptive of that time. And it's very rich. And it just took me back to these kind of places I could, you know, obviously would never have imagined.
I was trying to get a feel for the book and what it was about and kind of the language and the story. And I really loved this line at the end. Basically, you get the feeling almost that Balthasar could have been born at any time and have any kind of adventure. Constantinople could be Coventry, 1666 could be now or tomorrow, which probably makes Balthasar an everyman. It may make Maalouf a fabulist. Would you agree with that? Or?
You know what it is, yeah. So the character is, you almost feel you're in the character's bones, you know, and that's the nice thing about it is that everything, you can smell the smells, you know, see the sights and hear the sounds and feel that you know, that you're traveling on this journey with this character Balthazar. And it is. It's. I think it's because the character's so rich, it could be transplanted to any time, any place. I mean, I just don't think it'd be as exciting. You know, you walk through Coventry, you're looking at the old grey buildings from the 1970s. You know, it's like, well, it's Birmingham, but you know, it was kind of very rich and colourful. I just loved it.
I'd read that version though if you wrote it.
You've gone to Coventry now.
It sounds like there's a definitely a theme with all the books that you've picked. You know, you like these quests, these sort of people going on to finding themselves. You like very descriptive books, very big books.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they've ended up big. I mean, Balthazar's Odyssey is a kind of tiny one compared with the others. But yeah, I do. You know, I like when a story. This is one of the problems with books being adapted into movies. For me, the challenge is how do you tell such a rich and long story? You know, how do you bring it to life on the screen? And it was a big challenge for Lord of the Rings. And as a youngster, I followed all the various versions they did. Another book that also had that issue was Dune, Frank Herbert's book, because Dune is such a rich, rich story that you actually think, how could I actually make this into... Now, of course, the technology... You know, I just came out of watching Infinity Wars, and I love this kind of stuff. You know, I watched
Red Queen as a kid.
Yeah, no spoilers. No, don't worry. But it's really funny because they've introduced a lot of humor into these now as well. I think it's quite funny, and Thor is just such a witty character.
He's great. Yeah.
But the irony is that the cinematographic technology has allowed these stories to be so richly depicted on the screen, and I think that I hope will help books like Balthazar's Odyssey or you know, Thomas Covenant to come to life.
I think they're more likely to come to life in a better way on TV shows, at Netflix,
now,
or
because
with the storytelling and the pacing and stuff.
Right.
I think a movie is a bit unfair. I think Lord of the Rings is like an exception, really.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, they did a brilliant job with Lord of the Rings, if you think it, but it was across what four movies when you consider it.
Yeah, with The Hobbit.
And then The Hobbit as well, and three parts as well. So,
six altogether.
So many pieces to
Well, they're doing a Lord of the Rings series. I think Amazon has got the rights to that.
They are. It was going to focus around, I think, Aragorn when he was young.
Really?
Yeah, I read that somewhere.
Well, it's like you've got Han Solo now. So, you know, everything's an expansion.
Yeah.
You know, if it makes money.
Yeah, well, what do you think about this, though, from a kind of reader and consumer point of view? Do you get tired of seeing the same worlds and different kind of offshoots of those worlds instead of just different new stories?
Well, you know, I drew as a kid. I've been drawing. So I used to draw Spider-Man and Batman and Superman, and I was lucky. I could draw quite naturally. I could copy pictures almost perfectly. I put it down to being left-handed. I don't know. But so I spent a lot of time looking at these characters, studying them. But what was interesting, I read those comics, you know, as a kid quite intently. I was constantly reading, whether it was comics, books, whatever. But the characters have changed, so I don't get tired of it, only because there's a new interpretation constantly being added to it. I mean, if you look back, even the Star Wars movies, the original ones feel a little dated when you compare them to what they can do now. So, you know, and yet in those days, to see these hover jets and things was quite amazing. You know, the technology for cinema was considered amazing. That, I remember, in Battlestar Galactica, were the first that really made you feel you're in space.
I think it's fine to extend these stories, as long as it's warranted, as long as the stories are still good. You're not just using these names like Han Solo or Harry Potter or whoever to sell the movies. As long as the stories are good, like J.K. Rowling is writing all the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them films. She's doing the scripts, which I think makes sense. If they had somebody else doing them, I would be a little bit more wary of watching them.
This has been the challenge with James Bond now, of course. And I remember the interview you did, you know, with Horowitz on that. So it's a challenge having to write new books, with new authors taking other characters. Other people's characters.
But so. I think it's also unfair because I think there's so many new stories. We were talking before about the Children of Blood and Bones, you know. These new stories also need a space, I think, if they're going to be adapted into TV shows or movies.
I think it's a question of, you know, what do we have space for? As long as there's space for everything, I think, you know, retell as much as you like. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just a concern that a lot of stories that have already been told being retold when there are other stories that we haven't
yet
heard.
Like reboots. I'm not a fan of reboots.
Well, and to some extent I'm not, except that, you know, if you look at the way things can be rebooted as technology improves with special effects, suddenly it brings things. I mean, I'm glad they rebooted Lord of the Rings because there were two or three versions, a cartoon version and so on. And now, of course, if they try to reboot Star Wars, that would be awful because you can't. It's so entrenched now in a particular look and feel.
They rebooted Jumanji, which I think
Jumanji,
was a terrible idea.
I know it was. It didn't feel like Jumanji, but they did try to make it like a sequel almost.
Wait, what?
you didn't like, you liked it?
I loved it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I thought it was funny. I thought it was good, but I didn't feel it was the original Jumanji, because I love the original Jumanji. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, same. I mean, Robin Williams, you can't beat Robin Williams. Yeah.
We could argue about this all day. but I just wondered, because we're talking about films and adapting fantasy for the screen and whatnot. If there were a television series or adaptation of Balthasar's Odyssey, which I presume there isn't.
So far, as well, I know of nothing, no.
Who would you be casting? Like, what would you...
As Balthasar?
Do you think it could be done? Do you think they'd pull it off?
It could be done, yeah, absolutely. Now, with the kind of special effects and stuff possible, it's definite they could do something like that. But, I mean, the beauty would be to get the richness of the history and the feel of it. And you know, we're seeing elements of it when you see, even going back in time in some of the Marvel comics, or so not... Yeah, so much back in... Yeah, even some going back in time a bit, but things like the Mummy, when they set the scenes, mm-hmm. you get a feel of, you know, ancient Egypt or whatever. It's much better than it used to be.
Game of Thrones, when you watch those, a lot of those cities are based on ancient cities. Right. So,
I mean, yeah, you have to remember, I'm also of an age where I watched Star Trek, one of the first... shows made into color, which is why they wore these horrible crushed velvet outfits in bright yellow, red, blue.
I bet you've got one, haven't you?
I haven't. No, I never have. Though I did go to a party. I was actually a colleague of mine who's now actually quite well known on the BBC, does shows and stuff. Said I'm having a party. You know, it's fan. What's it called? I'm used
fan
to now.
Fiction.
No. It was a costume party. Oh, in America, but what do you call fancy dress? Sorry, I lived in America too long, so I called it costume party. I said I'm going to a fancy dress party. All the Americans, what the hell's fancy dress party? You know. So I went to this party dressed as because I was told make sure. She said to me, "Come up and said make sure you wear a good outfit." And I dressed up as Spock. So I had to, you know, I did a Star Trek badge. I drew it and I cut it out and I put sellotape on the tips of my ears to make them pointy. And, you know, I like even cut my fringe and gelled it down into a straight line. It was awful. I walked in and myself and my friend, I was the only one there, but my friend just as I walked in just looked at me and these people in horror, like this Spock has walked in with his trousers tucked into his socks and everything. It's awful. And I trekked across London on the tube for that. But I grew up in a time when, these characters, I mean, you know, you'd see someone get shot in Star Trek and they'd, you know, fall onto a boulder and the boulder would move because it was all plastic and polystyrene. So now we've got much better effects, yeah.
So no thoughts on who you think would play Balthasar?
It's funny. The first thing when you said that came into my head is that my daughter, who's 12, you know, she'd say Orlando Bloom. But he's done enough, I think. No, we'd have to find someone who's ethnically viable. Maybe I just saw Oscar Isaacson in a movie. When I looked at him, I just don't know. I just fits the look as well.
Yeah.
We're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. So just to recap the three books that you took with you to your desert island, for anybody who's just tuning in and wondering what Riz Khan would take.
What? You missed all of that. Shantaram, Gregory David Roberts, a book about a convict who flees Australia, set in the 80s, and ends up in the slums of Bombay in India, and goes on some incredible adventures, loosely based on his life. The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, The Unbeliever by Stephen Donaldson, fantasy fiction in the kind of, he was very influenced by Lord of the Rings, so it has that kind of feel to it, but it's more adult and kind of dark. And then the final one is Balthasar's Odyssey by Amin Maalouf, a Lebanese writer, very rich, colorful story about a man on a quest going across 17th century Europe and the Ottoman Empire in search of this very mysterious book.
Okay, well, with that, we release you from the island. Thank you so much for being such a good sport.
I was
sport.
Enjoying those seagulls.
Yeah. Well, you can have them again. No, we can't have them again. No, you've been denied seagulls. No. All right, well, thank you so much, Riz.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.